This narration that I just quoted, this is from Manaqib of Ibn Shahr Ashub, and he interestingly has combined this narration with the story of the conquest of Mecca, which is a symbolic meaning, which is very interesting, that when the Prophet, you know, was able to gain control of Mecca, one of the first things he does after going into Masjid al-Haram was to remove all the idols which were inside. And when all the idols had been removed, there was one big one on the roof of the Kaaba. So Rasulullah told Ali, let's go and remove this one. Now the roof of the Kaaba is not that, you know, short. It is, the ceiling is high there. And so, at the end, what happens? Rasulullah says, okay, you get on my shoulders. Remember, Muslims believe that the seal of Nubuwwat and Khatamiyat was on there. And Ali gets on the shoulders of Rasulullah to go on the top of the Kaaba, and then he threw down the idol. There were others, actually, who were saying, I wish we had this honor to do that. And Rasulullah says the honor goes only to the one who never ever worshipped an idol. Because most of the majority of the Sahaba were all mushrikeen before. And that is why you'll see that the Muslim world says that Ali, when they used to describe him, they would say, Karramallahu wajhu. Karramallahu wajhu means, may Allah honor his face. Because this forehead of Ali has never ever bowed down in front of an idol. Combining the story of, you know, removing the idol from the roof of the Kaaba, and Ali standing on the shoulders of Rasulullah, with this issue of sitting on the member, you know, in a way, Ibn Shahr Ashub is trying to say that, you know, if Ali can stand on the shoulders of Rasulullah, what problems do you have that if Ali sits on the same level as the member of Rasulullah?
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations WFP has expressed concern about the situation of children in Afghanistan, announcing that acute malnutrition rates are high in 28 out of 34 provinces of the country. The UN body says 3.5 million Afghan children currently need nutrition treatment. The head of Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital believes this situation is due to cuts in global aid and mass poverty triggered by U.S. sanctions.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers can't afford enough nutrients at the time of pregnancy. When the mother herself suffers from undernutrition, the baby, of course, becomes malnourished. In addition to providing milk and nutrients, health bodies should also provide such families with some cash aid for a specific period of time so that the mother and children don't face malnourishment after recovering.
Some Afghan mothers also say they can't provide their babies with needed nutrition, as their entire families are going without food to eat.
I'm a widow. I can't afford a packet of flour to cook bread.
My family members are going without food to eat. There is no male breadwinner in our household. This daughter of mine is malnourished, and I'm afraid the other children also become undernourished if this situation continues.
The UNHCR says that at the Antalya Diplomacy Forum, everyone agreed that in spite of the extreme gravity of the Ukraine situation, other crises, including that of Afghanistan, must not be forgotten. Afghans are also calling on Western powers not to ignore the crisis they caused in Afghanistan.
Western powers caused the situation in our country. They imposed the war and control everything here. Today they are shifting all attention to the Ukraine crisis. That is important, but what about Afghans' plight? They shouldn't forget poor and suffering Afghans.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and major funding to the country was halted. The developments affected lives across the country.
The situation is still perilous in Afghanistan, where millions of lives depend on foreign aid. Afghan people are calling on world countries not to forget them and to continue their assistance to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Majlis-e-Wahdat Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia targeted killings emerge in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate-mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims.
Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate-mongering to root out this threat from the society.
After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia-targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities Pasman e Azaa Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signalling another wave of Shia-targeted killing following the same decades-old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises. First in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last three decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
With the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, being just around the corner in Iran, people are getting prepared to welcome the arrival of spring. This comes as the sixth wave of coronavirus in Iran appears to have been subsiding now. The official daily number of fatalities, which had stood at 241 on February 27th, fell to below 120 over the past couple of days. The Persian New Year, or Nowruz, arrives on March 21st. The Nowruz holidays are traditionally a time when Iranians travel and visit each other. But health officials are worried that the exchange of visits and travels during the Persian New Year will lead to a new wave of COVID-19 if health protocols are not fully observed.
In view of the special feature of the Omicron variant, we highly request people to keep wearing masks and observe social distancing. Although many of them have been vaccinated, wearing a mask is still an important measure, especially when they are visiting relatives and friends during Nowruz.
I think everyone should receive the third dose of vaccine. And if you want to be safe, we should postpone our visiting and travels to some other time. If we don't take Omicron seriously, the next wave will sweep across the country again.
I have recovered from coronavirus almost 20 days now, but too much coughing hurts me a lot, and symptoms are still with me and my daughter. It's a bad disease, and people should not forget to observe the health protocols.
According to official statistics, over 56 million Iranians have received the second jabs of vaccines, while over 24 million others have been vaccinated with the third shot.
Under the travel rules released for Iran's third Nowruz with COVID-19, only those who have received at least two doses of vaccines are allowed to travel by their private cars across the country during the Persian New Year holidays. Otherwise, they will be fined. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a big ceremony to mark the 54th anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars. Israeli forces have also injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Hamas movement, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of committing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The amount, the volume, the size of the injury indicated that we are facing a criminal side, which is occupation. I think it is very important indication about the type and the impact of the Israeli actions, Israeli crimes against the Palestinian.
During the Israeli war in May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation.
We have to stress the role of the wounded in Palestine and their great role. They are Palestinian, you know, wounded are in the first line with the occupation. So they sacrifice with their bodies in order to, free Palestine.
Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries. The Islamic Jihad movement accused the United States of encouraging Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
I think that who give the Israeli the green lights, Americans, the United States of America, and the silence of people, which silenced all over the massacre which carried by the Israelis against our people, and also maybe the Arab position, so that the Israelis go on to hit, to destroy, to kill, to injure everything against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for wounded Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
South Korea elected a new president Wednesday as conservative People Power Party candidate Yoon Suk-yeol defeated progressive Lee Jae-myung by less than 1% after all the votes were tallied. Yoon was quick to outline the hard line he will take with North Korea.
In order to protect the safety of our people, property, territory, and sovereignty, we will build a strong military capacity that can reliably suppress any provocation. I'll firmly deal with illicit, unreasonable behavior by North Korea in a principled manner, though I'll always leave the door for South-North talks open.
North Korea conducted several missile tests in the weeks leading up to the election. Some analysts believe President-elect Yoon, a former prosecutor entering politics for the first time, will face some early challenges from Pyongyang.
The Conservative Party has been very critical of the government's position on military exercises. Of course, South Korea will come out with a new North Korea policy, but North Korea will also conduct a couple of activities to test the Yoon administration. I'm not sure whether this will lead to conflict or dialogue.
The Moon Jae-in administration had sought engagement with North Korea, but its policies were often stymied by a hardline U.S. approach. Yoon Suk-yeol's foreign policy marks a stark turnaround from outgoing President Moon Jae-in, particularly concerning North Korea. Yoon advocates the deployment of a second U.S. anti-ballistic missile battery to protect the capital, Seoul. The resumption of joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises and the preparation for South Korea's military to execute a preemptive strike on North Korea should Pyongyang pose an imminent threat. In addition to the difficult North Korea issue, President-elect Yoon will have to deal with a raft of domestic problems, including a housing price bubble and income gap, a surge in COVID-19, as well as rising inflation. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Cult in Heart of the Republic is the title of a book written by a member of the French Senate, Nathalie Goulet. In her book, she shines a light into the formidable anti-Iran terror group known as Mojahedin-e-Khalq Organization, or simply the MKO. The author tries to warn her fellow Senate members that a full-scale terror group exists in the heart of the French Republic. Here, in Iran's city of Qom, political thinkers and activists have gathered to unveil the first Persian translation of the French book.
In the book, A Cult in Heart of the Republic, Mrs. Goulet writes about grisly crimes against humanity perpetrated by the MKO and how they crushed all humanitarian principles to ascend to power in Iran. The author warns the French parliament that the formidable group now enjoys full financial support from Paris and is infiltrating into the French government.
The group also fought alongside Iraqi forces against Iran during the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s.
During the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the group tried to take power in Iran. But when they failed because of lack of popularity, they tried to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. The MKO brainwashes its members and does not allow them to get married and form a family. They are like a war machine which are designed to kill.
In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. The terror group was then relocated from an American military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Since then, the U.S. and Europe have been taking part in the MKO's annual summits in Paris. Nathalie Goulet's book tries to highlight the criminal track record of the MKO, while warning France that it's making a big mistake by supporting the terror group.
France is a country that claims to care about money laundering on the global stage. But based on Nathalie Goulet's book, the French government is conducting large-scale money laundering to fund the MKO terrorists. The U.S. also lends its political support to the terror group. This is both double standards and folly, because the MKO's functionality has long expired.
The MKO is currently led by 68-year-old Maryam Rajavi, who is facing pressure from French human rights entities as, quote, a smear on France's record of human rights advocacy.
Aside from warning France of the security threats posed to her country by the MKO, the French author says capitalizing on the terror group is nothing but a waste of time and money. She argues that the MKO is viewed as an obsolete killing machine in the minds of Iranians and has no place in Iran's sociopolitical structure. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Massive explosions lit up the night sky over Erbil, the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, in the early hours of Sunday. Initial reports pointed to the detonation of as many as 12 ballistic missiles. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles, targeting a strategic Israeli center for conspiracy and villainy. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting a furore. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. Some analysts believe Israel is pursuing several objectives in the Iraqi region.
Of course, they can also foment sectarianism in places like Iraq, you know, picking on individual weaknesses of people with the finances of the Americans or others. They can create, all sorts of divisions and hatred to create problems within these nations. And their primary purpose is really to encircle the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the only nation and the most powerful nation that stands up for the oppressed in that region. And the primary oppressor in that region, of course, is Israel.
The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. Words that will now sound even more reassuring to the nation and forbidding to its enemies.
In Paris, demonstrators gathered to warn that while the world is distracted by the conflict in Ukraine, pro-Zionists are stepping up their violence and oppression against Palestinians worldwide.
A steady trend of murders. I mean, 2-3 teenagers assassinated per week. Hundreds, if not thousands, of olive trees uprooted. Houses demolished, night arrests. It's going on continuously.
At the major pre-election dinner held by France's top Jewish lobby, known by the acronym CREEF, France's prime minister announced the banning of two pro-Palestinian groups. The administration of President Emmanuel Macron has falsely declared anti-Zionism to be the same as anti-Semitism, and has already closed many of the nation's top Muslim and anti-racist organizations. Many around the world have been shocked at the swiftness with which the West is sanctioning Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, noting that nothing similar was even remotely attempted to help Yemen, Palestine, and so many other non-white conflict areas. Unlike Ukrainian refugees to the European Union, Palestinian refugees aren't being awarded visa papers, the right to work, medical care, rights to housing, and other social services.
In France, the government, almost all the media, all the political parties immediately stand for Ukraine. In a way, they launch in a minute a practical BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Russia.
Western mainstream media and social media are openly encouraging armed resistance by Ukrainians against Russia, and yet resistance fighters in Palestine and other Muslim countries are called terrorists and subject to intense propaganda and censorship.
The double standards and Russophobia currently sweeping the West aren't just discrediting the West, they're providing a cover for far-right violence, oppression, and censorship. Many note that those aren't new policies for the West, and nowhere more so than in Palestine. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
As the vicious war in Ukraine rages on, refugees struggle to find somewhere, anywhere, safe to stay. The dominant media narratives are heavily focused on Russians and Ukrainians fighting each other. But here in Poland, Press TV found a unique exception. Meet Svetlana, a Ukrainian mother who fled Kyiv with her two children, Dmytro and Ksenia. They have been taken in by a native Russian who lives in Lublin with his Polish wife.
For me, it wasn't even choice. I just started to write
to my friends in the messengers and suggest them help or hosting. And I think it's the only choice I had. I feel angry that I can't stop it, I can't help.
Svetlana was forced to flee as the fighting surrounded the city. Her family have endured a 630-kilometer journey through the freezing cold. She tells us the ordeal has been traumatizing.
After the war started, it was a great fear that hit us. The first thing I did was turn on the news. Then I collected just 3 suitcases and suddenly we had to run. We didn't know what to pack, what to eat, what medicine to bring, how will we cook, and what about school. To be honest, to be less stressed, I just turned off my feelings. If I had time to think about all the danger, I'd probably go crazy. The journey we had to deal with and the uncertainty. It was physically very hard, and I was only allowed to relax and cry once we escaped.
Poland has become a beacon of sanctuary for many refugees, with some 1.5 million already entered the country and many more on the way.
Unfortunately, the refugee crisis has now become heavily politicized, specifically in the English-speaking world. But behind those headlines are just ordinary people trying to get by. Regardless of whether they speak Russian, Ukrainian or Polish, the civilians all ultimately want the same thing, regardless of where they come from. An end to the war. Robert Carter, Lublin.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned Britain against fracking as the world stands at a dangerous point in the climate crisis. Ban Ki-moon, now deputy chair of the Elders Group of former world statespeople and public figures, said countries face stark choices as a result of the conflict in Ukraine and the energy crisis, and must embrace renewable energy instead of returning to fossil fuels. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Ban Ki-moon Warns UK Against Fracking as World Stands at Dangerous Point. former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned Britain against fracking as the world stands at a dangerous point in the climate crisis. Ban Ki-moon, now deputy chair of the Elders Group of former world statespeople and public figures, said countries face stark choices as a result of the conflict in Ukraine and the energy crisis, and must embrace renewable energy instead of returning to fossil fuels. Ban Ki-moon said, "I think it's dangerous. Just look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report," he said, referring to the latest warning from scientists last month. Ban Ki-moon added, "I think it's dangerous. Just look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report," he said, referring to the latest warning from scientists last month. Ban Ki-moon added, "There is no time for us to lose. Even under normal conditions before the Ukraine conflict, we were far behind the pace." He warned that the conflict in Ukraine, as well as being outrageous in the 21st century, would have an impact on the climate crisis. Governments should not try to secure greater supplies of fossil fuels, he urged, as they sought alternatives to imports of oil and gas. Ban Ki-moon added, "This conflict will impact the international community's effort to address climate issues and the pandemic issues," he said in an interview. "I'm concerned that some European countries are even now considering how to address oil and energy shortages by seeking exports of some other sources of gas or oil." In the United Kingdom, there is some idea of releasing the ban on fracking. These are very short-term, unproductive ideas, he said. Fracking in the United Kingdom would be not a good idea, he added. It's a very short-term gain that will lose the long-term interests of humanity. Ban Ki-moon added, "I hope politicians have some longer vision for the benefit of the entire world." The British government signalled this week that fracking was still a possibility, though an unlikely one. Ministers have come under pressure to back fracking from some backbenchers and sections of the media, even though it is unlikely to be economically viable and would do nothing to ease the current crisis, as it would take years to produce any gas. Meanwhile, the European Union set out plans last week to cut its dependency on Russian oil and gas by two-thirds by the end of this year. Some of the slack will be taken up by seeking other suppliers, such as shipments of liquefied natural gas, LNG, and by expansion of renewable energy and push for greater energy efficiency. But expanding domestic fossil fuels, such as coal, may also be seen as a possibility if the conflict in Ukraine continues. Ban Ki-moon said that Germany, which has been phasing out coal, should not return to fossil fuels. Ban Ki-moon added, "Germany is the biggest economic power in Europe. They should not take this as a kind of short-term political gain." Ban Ki-moon also urged countries to consider nuclear energy, which he said would be a wise choice. He added, "There has been some debate and controversy on whether to use nuclear energy or not, but if we use a good energy mix with renewable energy, nuclear energy and other clean sources of energy, that's the way we can meet the target of carbon neutrality." "We have to use nuclear energy," he said. The conflict in Ukraine would affect preparations for COP27, the next United Nations climate summit, set to take place in Egypt this November, Ban Ki-moon warned. He added, "This is an issue for humanity and our planet Earth. This has nothing to do with politics. But, in reality, this may be affected by the current conflict in Ukraine." Ban Ki-moon visited Britain on Friday, 11th of March, to give a lecture at Oxford University and speak to Alok Sharma, the UK president of COP26, who will continue to lead the United Nations negotiations until this November. But their meeting had to take place online because Alok Sharma had contracted COVID-19. Ban Ki-moon urged rich countries to prepare for COP27 by providing more financial assistance to developing world governments to adapt to the impacts of climate breakdown, such as extreme weather, droughts, floods, heat waves and sea level rises. World leaders should really feel a sense of global responsibility, global justice and global humanity, and a sense of compassion for those people affected by climate breakdown, he said. Further comments, the former United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon said, "We have to listen to the recommendations of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the scientists. It's much more important than politics." Ban Ki-moon also said he was angry at countries' handling of the COVID-19 pandemic in its early stages, seeing a lack of multilateralism in the approach countries took after the outbreak was confirmed. He was also scathing about the role of the World Bank in the pandemic, saying it had not done enough. Ban Ki-moon added, "This is a serious issue. This is a lack of multilateralism. So I am, as a former United Nations Secretary General, really angry that we should suffer like this because the initial preventive measures have not been taken properly," he said.
To this point that Sheikh Shaltut, good communication with Ayatollah Burujerdi in Iran, give this picture that how the head of Al-Azhar is establishing relationship and communication with the head of Shia in the world of Islam.
One of the very important points that Sheikh Shaltut insisted on it is that tried to have the gathering and the mourning ceremony for the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in the day of Ashura in Al-Azhar University.
Be more familiar with outstanding figures in The Teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With you in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahtavi.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding Muslim figure from the Ahl Sunnah, from our Sunni brethren, who had role in establishing proximity among the different schools of thoughts of Islam inside the religion Islam, also one of the main founders of Darul Taqrib Bainul Mazahib al-Islami. He is no one but Mahmoud Shaltut, mainly known as Shaykh Shaltut, the outstanding university professor and the scholar of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. Shaykh Mahtavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some details about the early life of Shaykh Mahmoud Shaltut.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Shaykh Mahmoud Shaltut, born in 23rd April 1893. He was an Egyptian figure best known for his attempts in terms of Islamic reform and also Islamic unity, bringing about unification among different sects of Islam, mainly Shia and Sunni. Sheikh Shaltut, he was from one of the village of the province Behira, actually from one of the village of the Behira province in Egypt, and he completed his study in Alexandria, which was one of the affiliated
religious institute of Al-Azhar. Since he was a very talented student, he was invited to Al-Azhar University to complete his study. So he received his bachelor in Al-Azhar and finished off his degree, I mean PhD in Al-Azhar. So it was really important to be invited to Al-Azhar by the head or vice chancellor of the university at that time, who was Mustafa Al-Maraghi.
That's right.
He was invited to the University of Al-Azhar, and he had a very good cooperation with the head of the university because he believed and trusted Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut as one of the talented student and smart student. So I think this this is a very important part of his life that we have to give more focus and thought, because later on, inshallah, when we discuss about the achievements being done and conducted by Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, we are really in need of knowing that he was a very talented, smart student that graduated from Al-Azhar, and he was not the kind of normal student to graduate from the university. Why I'm saying these stuff, because when we reach, inshallah, later on in the following parts of our discussion for today, we will talk about the great and outstanding role that he, this student, played in the world of Islam.
That's right. Okay, thank you, Sheikh Mahdawi. Sheikh Ziyani, give us a picture of his Taghribi attempts. I mean, because his main, I think, interest was Taghrib al-Madhahib, and the look that he had at Jafariya school of thought in that time made him very much famous among the Shiite school of thought too. One of our Sunni brethren, you know, gave us a fatwa or a jawaz, a permission that we can say acting and practicing Islam according to the Jafariya school of thought is allowed, and this and that. I think this made the role of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut very much great. But what was happening before him, I mean, in the world of Islam? First give us that picture, and then we'll get to the attempts of Sheikh Shaltut himself.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my dear brother Sheikh Mahdawi mentioned, before Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi was the head of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. And we should know this, that Al-Azhar was a university,
yes,
but it was not an ordinary one, because the head of Al-Azhar was chosen by the president of Egypt directly.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not ordinary in, educational system that a president appoints the head of a university. But because Al-Azhar was a flag of Islam at that moment, and even nowadays it is, so it was in that high importance, in that level of importance, that the president of Egypt himself was appointing the chief and the head of this university. So this shows the importance of this university. Before Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi was the head of this university.
Yes.
And we should notice, and we should note this point, that the attempts of Taghrib and trying to get the scholars and the sects of Islam closer to each other, these attempts was started at the time of Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. And Sheikh Shaltut also was a teacher in Al-Azhar on that moment. He was amongst those ones who were doing their best to collect these scholars and to let them sit beside each other and have dialogue.
That's right.
But the most important event took place during the time of Sheikh Shaltut.
That's right.
And that was after the establishment of Darut Taghrib. Because Darut Taghrib was the center that was established at the time of Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. Mm-hmm. And Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut was also one of the scholars who were amongst the organizers and the establishers, those ones who put the milestone and the, starting point of this,
Foundation.
Yeah.
An institution, that's right.
Institution, yeah.
Okay.
So, after the establishment of Darut Taghrib, that we may discuss about it later, this movement started. And day by day, having these dialogues,
these scholars came to this point that, okay, we may have some differences, but the common points are much more than the differences that we have.
That's right.
So that's why they came to this point that, okay, let us highlight and put emphasis on the common points and also have scholarly discussions about the differences that we have. But let us forget about fighting each other.
That's right.
Let us forget about, you know, addressing each other as infidel or kafir or mushrik or, you know, some words like this that make people angry and make them to have, you know, severe actions against each other.
Sorry, was the atmosphere on that time over the wall of Islam like today? I mean, the Takfiri ones were in power, or the Wahhabism?
Sure, yeah.
It was an...
You know,
it was, okay.
The starting point of Darut Taghrib was this.
Mm-hmm.
A Shia Muslim in the Masjid al-Haram.
Yes.
He went for doing Hajj,
yes.
Baytullah al-Haram. And during Hajj, he faced with problem, you know, health problem, and he vomited mm-hmm. inside Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
And the guards of Masjid al-Haram, they took him, arrested him, and put him in court. And they accused him of disrespecting Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
And the judge, because he was Shia, they said that he was kafir, and he had done this action intentionally inside Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
So the verdict was execution. And the man was executed inside Mecca. So it was really a shocking news to the Muslim world.
On that time, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
It's something about 10, 15, or the maximum is 20 years before it started the establishment of Darut Taghrib.
Okay.
So it shows the atmosphere of Muslim world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That hatred is amongst some Muslims in a way that they are accusing a sick man
mm-hmm.
that he unintentionally had vomited inside Masjid al-Haram, but they have executed him.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this action.
Really harsh sentence for
so, a man. So yeah, in this atmosphere, Sheikh Shaltut is trying to get sects beside each other, closer to each other, and putting them under the same umbrella. So that's why this, you know, efforts are really notable and important.
Very good, very good. Really nice efforts from his side. So how did he do it? So in such an atmosphere, in Egypt and Al-Azhar, you know, and we know that socio-political affairs are also playing their roles in the society. So I think Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut's responsibility was really difficult, isn't it, to establish a dialogue between our Sunni brethren and the Shia ones. How did he do it?
Yes, that is a good question. When we read the history, we see that this was not something to take place haphazardly.
Yes.
All of the sudden, you see that such a man is trying to issue the verdict mm-hmm. in order to include Shia as the Muslim sect.
Yes.
Actually, as a
Shia was
official.
A Muslim sect. Officially, okay.
Officially.
Yes.
Officially, because this is a very important point, specifically for Sunnis.
Yes.
Why? Because all things that today we see, excommunicating of yes. Shias, this is because of the verdict that allowed them, considering Shias mm-hmm. out of the Islam. Then they kill. Then they go to executing people. Why?
Yes.
Because they consider them as non-Muslim. Mm-hmm. So if they are mushrik, if they are kafir, this act of excommunication
yes.
takes place under this ideology that Shia are not included under Muslim sects.
So we should say that even to non-Muslims, such behaviors are condemned, okay, let alone to the Muslims. Okay.
Yes.
So
we see that such achievements didn't take place all of the sudden. So when we read the history and the biography of Sheikh Shaltut, we see besides these actions, he was really active in both sides and both grounds. Both in theory and action.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of theory and spreading the theory of Wahda and unification, we see how he started or established the chair for Fiqh al-Muqaran. What is the concept of Fiqh al-Muqaran?
Yes, it
is a comparative study on the Fiqh jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm.
So it will enable students to know about other
fiqh as well. It is not only to read and study fiqh ahl sunnah. Mm-hmm. When you are talking about fiqh al-muqaran, it enables students to get to know about the jurisprudence of other sects of Islam like Zaydis or Shias. Okay. So when they go and study Shia jurisprudence, they will find on their own that there are a lot of similarities that they are not told about it. So this opportunity to bring about this opportunity and chances for the student and new generation to get to know about other sects will pave the ground for the moment that you want to establish the unity in the ground. I mean, in action. Okay. So this is one of the things that he did. And besides this, we have to say that the good communication that he had with Ayatollah Burujerdi in Iran, who would consider as the main leader or marja in Iran, of the Shia.
Yes.
So this is also one of the good action which give this picture that if those people, meaning Shia, are not considered as Muslim, if they are deserve to be treated that way that my brother mentioned in Mecca, how the head of Al-Azhar is establishing relationship and communication with the head of Shia in the world of Islam. So we have to look at these actions that he took. Yes. So when we read the history, we come to this point that Sheikh Shaltut, he was not only the man of speech or talking or only talking about the theories.
Yes.
We know how it is difficult to take the political stance specifically against Israel. So he was one of the people who took a very severe stance against the invasion of Israel.
That's right.
And interestingly, after the arrest of Ayatollah Khomeini, Imam Khomeini, before the revolution, it was known of Ayatollah Khomeini, in the demonstration of June 1963, he also took a very harsh stance against the Shah of Iran. He made a telegraph to the Shah of Iran that you are not allowed to disrespect. So these kind of action, if we put all of them all together, will pave the ground for Sheikh Shaltut and will give him this position to lead this movement, I mean the movement of unity and unification among the Shia sects. So based on what I said at the beginning of this discussion, we also must take into consideration one very important point. What is that point? Is that all these actions are taking place when he is reaching his 60s. So at that time, he is a mature, knowledgeable
man.
He was not a young man to say because of getting excited of some sort of news, he had taken these actions. And at that time, when he was 63, he was leading Al-Azhar University. So having all those knowledge about Sunnism, including Shia as one of the Muslim sects, and issuing this verdict publicly that no one has right to disrespect them. Even you can actually lead your salat behind them. You can pray your salat behind them.
Even he did it behind Ayatollah
Himself
Kashif al-Ghita.
That's right. So these actions empowered him of getting this position in the world of Islam.
That's all right. Very good. Very great achievements by Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut. He has also several books. The most outstanding one is a tafsir. I think this taqribi look, I think, can be seen in his tafsir or exegesis of the Holy Quran too. Okay, Sheikh Ziyania, your final words about him. Do you have anything to say?
Beside all these efforts that my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, we should notice that acting in accordance with your beliefs is not easy, and you should take hard steps. And Sheikh Shaltut took these steps. For example, Majma' al-Bayan is a very famous exegesis on Holy Quran written by Marhum At-Tabarsi rahmatullah alayh. And Majma' al-Bayan is a tafsir in which we see that the theories and the ideas of Sunni scholars are also reflected in this tafsir. And Sheikh Shaltut, according to a wise decision, decided to write an introduction for this tafsir. So he introduced Majma' al-Bayan to the world of Sunni scholars that look, this is a Shia tafsir, this is a Shia commentary on the Holy Quran, and it's full of the ideas of Sunni scholars.
Interesting.
So how do you blame these this school of thought to be, you know, not a part of Islam, while their scholars are reflecting our ideas?
Interesting.
Besides this, one of the very important points that Sheikh Shaltut insisted on it and tried to break the atmosphere against this action is that, you know, the day of Ashura amongst some of Sunni communities or some of Sunni Muslims is known as Eid. Unfortunately,
okay.
And many of them, they are not aware of the event that took place in this day.
Yes.
I've even witnessed myself in different countries in Africa that people are not aware of the story that took place in this day. And they say, okay, this is the day of fasting. That's why Sheikh Shaltut tried to have the gathering and the mourning ceremony for the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in the day of Ashura in Al-Azhar University.
Very good.
And this is very important that in the heart of the ideology of Sunni school of thought, that is Al-Azhar, you held a ceremony for the sake of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, the grandson of the Holy Prophet, and to keep the memory of the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, to make people aware of what happened.
That's right.
And to let them know that, okay, be respectful toward the grandson of Holy Prophet.
Yes.
So Sheikh Shaltut was taking very wise steps in this regard, forgetting about the differences, of course, not neglecting. There are some, you know, differences, but overlooking the differences and try to highlight the common points as Quran tells us regarding the our inner relationship with non-Muslims. قُلْ يَا أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ تَعَالَوْا إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ أَلَّا نَعْبُدَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. So it's more emphasis regarding the Muslims themselves. So if we have to talk with non-Muslims, it's obvious that we are more in need to have dialogue with Muslims. So Sheikh Shaltut was amongst those figures that did his best in this regard and paid also for this way.
Right.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul.
And also paved the way, I think, for the next generation of the, you know, coming generation of Sunni brethren to establish dialogue with our Shiite ones around the world. And this is a look that Islam really needs in today's world in order to forget the bias, prejudice, you know, and extremism and get to the main pillars of Islam. Thank you very much. About his demise, 1963, coinciding with 1383, according to the Hijra calendar, he passed away in Cairo in Egypt and was buried over there. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyania and Sheikh Mahdavi, for a nice elaboration on the life of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, one of the most outstanding Sunni brethren and one of the establishers of Dar al-Taghrib Bayn al-Mazahib al-Islami. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.